This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Well, tonight, in a primetime address, President Obama will make his case for U.S. intervention in Syria. That speech slated for 9:01 and 30 seconds p.m., 90 seconds for the networks to do a read-in before that red light goes on top of the teleprompter in the White House. The speech follows a week of intense rallying from the Obama administration and its allies and comes just as an alternative proposal by the Russians is picking up substantial support. Officials in Moscow say they are working with authorities in Syria toward a plan that would require the Assad regime to give up its stockpiles of chemical weapons and verify they have been turned over. Early today, France announced it would draft this proposal in the form of a UN Security Council resolution. President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry both said they would support such a plan if it could be carried out with some certainty. Listen.
He could turn over every single bit of his chemical weapons to the international community in the next week. Turn it over, all of it, without delay, and allow a full and total accounting for that. But he isn't about to do it.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry speaking at a joint news conference in London in remarks that seem to be off the cuff and contemporaneous, but they launched this entire cascade of events. Now, the White House was clearly surprised by John Kerry's comments, but President Obama jumped on board in this interview with NBC News.
We're going to make sure that we see how serious these proposals are. And my preference consistently has been a diplomatic resolution to this problem.
Now, since that interview, Syria has said it accepts the proposal from Moscow, but there are still a lot of questions about how to verify that Syria can and will carry through on its obligations under this proposed plan. It is a fluid situation. For more on how President Obama may navigate this increasingly complex Syria puzzle is Jeremy Shapiro. He's former advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on North Africa and Syria, now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And thanks for being on. Well, it is a fluid and changing situation. Advisors and speechwriters looking toward a primetime address like this prefer to not have events shifting under the ground. Give us a sense of how national security advisors and even speechwriters would be approaching the president's message this evening at 9 with the situation so very fluid.
Yeah, it's certainly a frightening thing for advisors. The last thing you want is your principal, as they call it, to be out in front of events and to be unaware of things that might have happened since he started speaking. And that actually seems to be a reasonable possibility in this situation since things have changed so quickly. I think what you want to do in this situation is make sure that the president, in this case, sticks to the principles on which he has articulated his policy. In this case, that means he's going to be focused fairly narrowly on the issue of chemical weapons and on the threat that they pose to the United States security, to proliferation, to the region, and to the Syrian people. And he's going to be focused on what the U.S. and the international community can do to ensure that Assad doesn't commit any more chemical attacks.
So the president, you're saying, has to speak to his original message, his difficult sales job to convince Americans and their representatives in Congress that intervening in Syria is the right thing to do. At the same time, it seems to me he has to closely acknowledge that there could be a way out here. The world is talking about a potential way out.
Well, that's what I mean by focusing on his principles, actually. His principle is not intervention, and I think sometimes that has gotten lost. But I think in the quote that the president just made on your program, he did articulate that. His principle has always been getting rid of chemical weapons, getting rid of Assad's ability to use chemical weapons against his population or proliferate them. And one of the methods that he had proposed for that was intervention. And that's the way that he thought he was going, I think, up until yesterday. But I think in a coercive threat, you have to be willing to take surrender. And arguably what the Syrians through the Russians have done is surrender in the face of the coercive threat. And that's, you know, of course, better for everyone if it's really true. The difficulty will be, and I'm sure the president will emphasize this, that it's going to be very difficult to implement a program like this. Secretary Kerry was almost dismissive of the possibility of implementing a program like this. And the United States has a long and unhappy history in trying to implement a similar program in Iraq. And so the devil will be in the details on that. But I think that the president wants to focus people on the fact that the goal here is to get rid of the chemical weapons, and he's going to do what needs to be done to do that.
What is the function of the breathing room that this seems to have engendered, both for the White House and for lawmakers, evidenced by the fact that a congressional vote, a Senate vote scheduled for tomorrow, just after the president's address, has been put off by Harry Reid? Lawmakers now want to see which way the wind is blowing. They want to see where this is going to go. That means, it seems to me, that means something good for the president. He can loosen his collar a little bit.
Yeah, I think that that's right. It's very clear that neither the president nor the Congress, either the Democrats or the Republicans, were really relishing this vote. For the president, the idea, which looked to be a real possibility, although it certainly wasn't certain, that he would lose this vote would be a serious political blow. And for the Congress, the last thing they wanted to do was be on the record as allowing Assad to use chemical weapons against his people, or alternatively be on the record and supporting an intervention that the American people very clearly don't want. So this is a sort of deus ex machina for both the president and the Congress, and I think that's why you saw so many people seize on it so quickly.
Jeremy, how surprised were you yesterday at the turn of events on the international stage? What seemed like an off-the-cuff remark, or even, as would be referred to in Washington, a gaffe from John Kerry, seems to have set off this cascade of events. You don't usually see somebody gaffing up. It may actually solve this crisis. Were you as surprised as everybody else to see John Kerry's erstwhile gaffe really sort of yield something like this?
It's unprecedented in my view. I've never seen anything quite like it. And I can tell you that, of course, gaffes are not uncommon, and even what Michael Kinsley called a Washington gaffe, which is when you accidentally tell the truth,
indeed,
is not, you know, an uncommon thing. But it does make people listening, the advisors behind the scenes or the bosses behind the scenes listening to it, cringe generally. And I'm sure when this originally came out, the White House was probably quite furious that this complication had been thrown into the mix. And, you know, the idea that you're going to allow through an unplanned a comment like this, allow the Russians to take the diplomatic initiative, is not something which can appeal to the U.S. government. But, you know, at the end of the day, if it works out, it works out. And stranger things have happened, I suppose.
I can't think of one right now, but Jeremy Shapiro, if you say stranger things have happened in diplomatic circles, I'll definitely believe you. We thank you for your insight. That's Jeremy Shapiro, former advisor to Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State on North Africa and Syria, now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. We'll be watching the speech along with the rest of us at 9:01 and 30 seconds tonight. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you.
As President Obama and politicians on both sides of the aisle debate whether to intervene in Syria, the humanitarian crisis there continues to grow. More than 2 million Syrian refugees have now fled their home country into places like Jordan and Iraq, Turkey and Lebanon. More than half of those refugees are children. The camps are overcrowded. Aid groups are struggling to provide adequate food and medical care to those displaced by the fighting. Joining us now is Dr. Hamam Akbik. Dr. Akbik is a Syrian-American who is working with refugees near the capital of Amman in Jordan. Dr. Akbik, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Todd. Thank you for hosting me.
Doctor, we had your wife, Besma, on the show yesterday from Cincinnati, so we wanted to get your perspective since you're there near Amman, Jordan. Can you describe conditions at the refugee camps that you've been working in?
Well, actually, our missions are a little bit different as we don't go to the camps. What we've noticed throughout the previous missions that we went through in Jordan, that most of the needs are outside the camps. The camps right now host about 165,000 displaced Syrians and being covered by about 7 to 9 medical units from various countries. The Jordan in as a country hosts close to 600,000 displaced Syrians that's outside the camp. So the need is outside the camp are way more than the need in the camp, and that's where our focus is.
So there has to be enormous stress then on the existing services that Jordanians use for their own health care, their own food. Those systems have to be very stretched now.
To the utmost limit. Jordan is not really a wealthy country, and people here are on average poor, and they can host to a limit. The food, the water, that's all scarce here, so it's very hard for the families to support themselves, not alone now, support extended families and displaced Syrians. So it's becoming quite a struggle for the locals and for the displaced Syrians.
And what does that mean for your services and what you're trying to provide to the Syrians?
it's becoming harder and harder because you have now more displaced people, you have more scattered. So it's much easier when you come to an area where a lot of displaced Syrians are there, so you can provide your services and move on. The problem now, you have hundreds here, hundreds there, and it's becoming harder and harder to get to them because they're getting more and more further away from major cities. So delivering aid is becoming much harder. And plus, all the big organizations that affiliate with the United Nations, they do not go after small groups. They want to go to an area where it's populated and focus on big groups. And that's the problem right now in Amman, that that is no longer the case. So who is going to care for those people? Who is going to deliver the care? Who's going to deliver the medical care? Who's going to give them medication? Who's going to deliver baby formulas? That question remains to be answered. And we are trying to be one organization that trying to put some closure to this question.
And before we let you go, Dr. Haman Akbik, there is a rapidly shifting political situation, of course, between the United States, Syria, and Russia. What are you hearing from the people that you talk to? It seems like a diplomatic settlement could potentially avert a threatened U.S. strike if this deal to have the international community take possession of chemical weapons goes through. Are people expressing relief or hope at that? What are you hearing?
This is here quite interesting because there is a complete lack of trust and belief in the United States credibility anymore. You can hardly believe anybody right now. You go and ask them and they believe in the United States. They said, unfortunately, Obama is not a man of his word. They think that the U.S. government is playing political games with their future. Every person here you talk to, really, nobody is really supporting the intervention unless if they want to know that it's going to put an end to this madness, it's going to put an end to this killing, it's going to put an end to this mass exits. But if it's only going to be to settle some scores between the U.S. and Russia, so now if they delivered the chemical weapons, so it's okay to kill with other weapons, but not okay to kill with chemical weapons, I am not sure what exactly the settlement is about right now.
That settlement is fluid. The potential settlement in the situation is far from solved, but it is moving quickly. Dr. Haman Akbik, we want to thank you for joining us from near Amman. Dr. Akbik is a Syrian-American working with the National Arab Medical Association outside of Amman and around towns in Jordan helping Syrian refugees housed there. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you.
Later this hour, we're talking about your fondest memories of AM radio.
My name is Doug Taves. I'm calling from Chisago City, Minnesota. My fondest memory of AM radio was when I was a child, and all the brothers had gone off to school. I got to listen to Kindergarten of the Air coming from the Canadian Broadcast Company. It was a great memory.
Kindergarten of the Air. On our Facebook page, George writes this: my fondest memory is that I was able to build a simple AM receiver with a nail, some wire, a razor blade, and an earpiece. This opened a whole new world to me as a child, probably led to my future in broadcast technology. Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE. Be part of this conversation. And if you're like George, we want to see photos of your AM radio. You can post them at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry. Well, back in May, Missouri state legislature passed a bill that nullifies all federal gun laws in that state. Not only does the bill nullify those federal gun laws within the state boundaries, but it also contains language stating that agents enforcing federal gun statutes, federal agents, could be subject to lawsuits for attempting to enforce those federal gun laws within Missouri's borders. Democratic Governor Jay Nixon vetoed that bill last month, citing the Constitution. But on Wednesday, the legislature convenes again, and it looks like there may be enough votes for an override. Well, joining us now is one of the Republican representatives in the Missouri State Legislature. He's Representative Jay Barnes, and he was the only Republican in the legislature to vote against that bill in May. Joins us from Columbia. Hi, Representative Barnes.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And thanks for joining us. I'm going to assume that a lot of what's going on in Missouri stems from Sandy Hook, gun control reactions to Sandy Hook, and the controversy since. Is that about right, that that's where this stems from?
I think so. There was a lot of talk on the national level of new gun control measures, which are not popular in Missouri, and I think for good reason. I'm a guy who has a perfect Second Amendment voting record. Unfortunately, some folks took that and went not just a little too far, but way too far with the reaction to that. I think a lot of folks who voted for this bill the first time around thought of it as a symbolic vote. But if you look at the actual details of the bill, something that doesn't actually even protect the Second Amendment, let alone the practical defects where you talked about criminalizing the actions of ordinary law enforcement officers who try to keep drugs and criminals off our streets.
Now, this bill says that a federal agent who tries to enforce, you know, a DEA agent or FBI who tries to enforce federal gun laws on the streets of St. Louis, maybe, could be sued by the person he or she arrests.
That's right. And that part of the bill is clearly unconstitutional. It's amazing to me that the folks who brought this bill think it defends the Second Amendment when it obliterates the structure of the Constitution, which protects the Second Amendment rights of Americans across the entire country. I'll give you an example. There's a couple of recent Supreme Court cases, a case from District of Columbia that ruled that handgun bans were unconstitutional, and a case that came out of Chicago that said for the first time in 200 years of Supreme Court jurisprudence that the Second Amendment was incorporated to apply against cities and states. If the supporters of this bill had their way, that Second Amendment would not apply to those cities and states because those cities and states, just like the supporters of this bill say Missouri can just make its own law and ignore what the Supreme Court says, those cities and states could do the same thing. And I think that's an insane result for folks who claim to be supporters of the Second Amendment.
Now, you voted against this bill when it was a bill on the floor, but it passed with 109 of your Republican colleagues voting for it along with 11 Democrats. It needs just about that number for an override, and it has just about the same number of votes in the Senate. You know, in Washington, override votes are sometimes different than voting on the bill. Do you have a sense that some people will back off if it means actually making this thing law in Missouri?
It's going to be really close. People have actually looked closer at the details of the bill. It is no longer a symbolic vote. A lot of times what you'll see happen with bills is if they don't get to the target number, the bottom will drop out of them. I don't think this bill is going to pass tomorrow. But we'll see. I've been surprised other times.
It's a fascinating situation. We're speaking with Representative Jay Barnes from Columbia, Missouri. He's the only Republican in Missouri state legislature to vote against a bill that nullifies all federal gun laws. Representative Barnes, I wonder, in your discussions with colleagues as you lobby on this or just talk to your friends in the legislature there, does Article 6 of the Constitution come up at all? Article 6 is the supremacy clause that establishes the Constitution and federal law as the supreme law of the land and says all judges in cities and states have to obey federal law, that the Constitution is fairly clear on this.
Well, some folks have a different read on the supremacy clause than what the Supreme Court and every other court in the country has had for 200 years. What I've been telling folks is there's more proof to the existence of unicorns than there is to the constitutionality of this bill.
So you tell them it's going to be struck down anyway?
Well, most of it will be struck down. There are provisions in it which are constitutional, and those are the provisions which limit the actions of state law enforcement officers. States, of course, have the ability to tell law enforcement officers within their own borders and employed by either the state or local government entities within the state what they can and cannot do. Those aren't agents of the federal government, and we've got some. There's some provisions of this bill that limit the actions of state law enforcement officers, which I think actually would survive a constitutional challenge and would make it more difficult, if not impossible, to conduct a lot of raids on crack houses and meth labs mm-hmm. around the state of Missouri, which I think is a terrible result.
It's an extraordinarily interesting constitutional state of affairs in the show-me state, the state of Missouri. Representative Jay Barnes is a Republican in the state legislature, but the only Republican to vote against a bill nullifying all federal gun laws in the state of Missouri. And just so we're clear, Representative Barnes, you think this override effort fails tomorrow? Closely.
I think it's going to be very close. If if you had to make me say one side or another, I would say I think it's going to fail.
We're going to be watching that vote closely, too. Representative Jay Barnes, Republican from Columbia, Missouri, thank you.
Thank you.
Later this hour, the future of AM radio may be in doubt, but its past is well remembered by radio fans like us and by you.
Marilyn Lowe of Eugene, Oregon. And my most exciting moment of AM radio was on September 9th, 1965.
And Koufax ready and delivers. Curve ball for a strike.
Sandy Koufax was pitching that night, and I took my transistor radio with me and listened with an earbud to Vin Scully as he broadcast the play-by-play of Koufax's perfect game on KFI radio.
Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung out and missed the perfect game.
Share your fondest memories of AM radio in mono and not stereo, if you please. Give us a call at 877-8MYTAKE. Tweet us at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry, broadcasting to at least some of you over AM radio.
With oldest regret, she's unable to lunch today.
Ah, the golden days of radio, when big bands and world-ending dramas ruled the airwaves.
Wait a minute, something's happening. There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head-on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods. The fires are spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill.
The War of the Worlds changed the way entertainment was perceived by a new phenomenon, millions of listeners. And you didn't need a 70-inch HD TV or Dre Beats headphones to take it all in. No, you only needed to turn the dial. In the days before the FM frequency, and of course television and internet and smartphones, the AM frequency was the go-to spot for news.
Just to bring you up to date on the news of Europe, if you are just turning on your radios, Great Britain is now at war with Germany. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain announced this fact in a broadcast at 6:15 New York time, 6:15 Eastern Daylight Time. A brief broadcast of about 5 minutes duration, which was carried over the CBS network.
It's where America listened to live sports.
Two strikes, ball one. Here comes the pitch. Strike three. A no-hitter, a perfect game for John Larson. Yogi Berra runs out there. He leaps on Larson, and he's slammed by his teammates. Listen to this crowd roar.
It's where you went to hear the President of the United States.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. I recognize that the many proclamations from state capitals and from Washington, couched for the most part in banking and legal terms, ought to be explained for the benefit of the average citizen.
And of course, all that music.
In New York City, we entertain you. So plan your weekend with music and us.
As of late 1978, half of all radio listeners tuned into the AM dial. And some of you remember listening to AM way back in the day.
Hi, this is Jen in Philo. My fondest AM radio memory is waking up for years weekdays at 6 a.m. to...
And we're getting lots of your stories and memories of AM radio.
Hi, this is Susan. I'm calling from Fort Lauderdale. You really sparked some memories. The best ones are for KDKA Pittsburgh when I was growing up in the 50s.
1020 KDKA Pittsburgh.
It was Reg Kordick and his cast of crazies in the morning in the kitchen while we were getting ready for school. And, of course, you know you're praying for those magic words, Due to the snow, the following schools will be closed today.
This is Mike in Pflugerville, Texas. When I worked the graveyard shift, I discovered Art Bell Coast to Coast AM. It was a fascinating show where people could discuss the paranormal and conspiracy theories and fringe science in a serious way at 3 a.m.
I grew up listening to AM. It's what got me interested in radio in the first place. Jim Bohannon, Rush Limbaugh, my Philadelphia Flyers. I could listen to any station from across America, from the West Coast to Minnesota. Well, we're talking more about AM radio next. And if you're listening to us on an AM radio right now, send us a photo of the set or device you use for AM radio in 2013. You can post that to our Facebook page at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Well, we're taking some time to celebrate the golden days of AM radio, what was once a main source of communication and entertainment all across this country. In the 21st century, with FM radio and the internet and smartphones, AM listenership has fallen to just 15% of total radio listeners. That's an average of 3.1 million people. That's according to a survey by Verona Sewler Stevenson. In the 70s, over 60% of all listeners. So where's the love gone? Stolen by those fancier electronics? Heck, do you even own an AM radio anymore? Who's going to fight for AM radio? That's my question. Who will stand at the precipice and support a pillar of our broadcast world? How about the lone Republican on the FCC? Ajit Pai, a commissioner at the Federal Communication Commission, who hopes to turn this trend around. Hi, Ajit.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on, or should I say, Mr. Commissioner? You know, I don't know that I've had any more fun than hearing the control room here at The Takeaway put my voice there in that essay into mono, non-stereo AM sound. It's great.
There's something about that sound, isn't it? It just brings back nostalgic feelings for everybody, from kids who listen to baseball games at night to truckers who used to drive across the country. There's something for everybody in AM radio.
What's your favorite nostalgic memory of AM? You're a child of the 70s, I guess.
I am. So I still remember my freshman year in 1987 of high school. My mom wouldn't let me go to the state high school basketball championship game. So I went to my room, tuned in to KLKC 1540 AM, and listened to the game there. And I mean, at the time, I was a little bit aggrieved, as you might imagine. But now I have such fond memories of it, and it's all because of AM radio.
Okay, so much for nostalgia. In the present day, you're on the Federal Communications Commission. What's happening in terms of bandwidth, in terms of the public airwaves, that's pushing AM out? I understand that the signal is tinny. It doesn't sound modern. What's happening sort of in the regulatory world that's making it a tough road for AM?
Well, I think you put your finger on the basic problem, which is that because of interference from a variety of sources, it's very difficult to get a quality AM signal anymore. That could be because of everything from all the appliances that you have in your home to the power lines that are above when you're driving. And so one of the goals that I've had at the FCC is to try to examine whether or not there are things that we can do to improve the band. It's been 22 years since we comprehensively reviewed our AM radio rules. And as I scoured into the rule books, what I found was that a lot of the regulations we have on the books inadvertently have kept AM back. And so I hope to convince my colleagues to tweak those rules so we can have AM radio thrive once again.
Now, a cynical person or somebody who understands politics might just say, all right, that's great. I love AM radio too, but you're an FCC commissioner and you're just trying to keep some of your regulatory territory here so it doesn't die out.
No, quite to the contrary, actually. I want us to remove some of those regulations so that we can let all these AM broadcasters, whether they are in urban areas or rural areas, whether they're in Alaska or Florida, whether they are minority owners. AM radio was historically a gateway for minority ownership. We want to let all of the AM broadcasters thrive without the worry of regulation standing in the way.
And is this just a question of allowing them to boost their signal so they're more powerful? What does it really mean?
So there are a number of different proposals on the table. One is for an increase in the power. One is also to convert all the analog stations over to digital. One is to allow them to broadcast over on the FM side through the use of what's called a translator. There are a number of different solutions on the table, and I don't take a definitive position on which one the FCC should adopt. I think we should tee them all up and see what all the broadcasters, the engineers, the technologists, what they think is the best way to go, and then take the appropriate action.
All right. Well, before we let you go, Ajit Pai, you have nostalgia for AM. I have have nostalgia for AM. Our control room definitely has nostalgia for AM. But nostalgia can be dangerous. We don't want to live in the past. The market rules. What's really wrong with letting AM die if we've moved on technologically?
Well, believe me, I am a firm believer in the fact that the market rules, and that's precisely why I want to allow AM to have a fair shot at competing for listenership. There still continues to be a place for broadcasting and for AM radio in particular. The question is, how do people want to get information? And if AM radio broadcasters are able to provide information that people want, I'm pretty convinced that the market, along with advertisers, will shift their way. And so, again, once we get rid of some of those rules, AM radio may have a fair shot. And if they don't if they don't succeed on their own merits, then that's great. But hopefully the rules don't prevent them from doing that.
Ajit Pai, the lone Republican on the Federal Communications Commission supporting AM radio at the FCC. Mr. Pai, thank you.
Thanks again for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. I got a question for you. What if you could see a moving picture, a movie of cosmic history? This would be a movie spanning back, 8 billion years in time with 300 million characters, all of them galaxies. Thanks to the work of several scientists, you are soon going to be able to do just that. The project is called the Dark Energy Survey, and it uses a gigantic digital camera, the most powerful ever, to snap pictures of far-out galaxies and exploding stars back to 8 billion light-years from Earth. Scientists hope that this information the camera gathers will help them solve one of the universe's biggest mysteries. Why are distant galaxies flying apart at an ever-accelerating rate? They should be contracting. Joshua Freeman is director of the Dark Energy Survey and a scientist at Fermilab. He is also professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago. Hi, Dr. Freeman.
Hello.
570 megapixels in the Dark Energy Survey camera. Is that correct?
That's right.
I believe there's a brand new iPhone coming out today. How many iPhones is 570 megapixels?
Oh, gosh. I think when I last counted, iPhones were about 8 megapixels, so it's a lot.
All right. So Apple has nothing on you. Explain how this works. A powerful camera, okay, mounted on top of a great big telescope I heard in Chile, and then what do you do?
So basically, starting last Saturday and over the next 5 years, we're going to use this camera to make a big map of the universe. We're going to cover about an eighth of the total sky. And as you mentioned, over that period, we will catalog, measure positions and properties of about 300 million galaxies at the present time and going back in kind of time slices of the universe back 8-10 billion years. And we'll use that to try to figure out why the universe is speeding up rather than slowing down.
It should be slowing down because just like dropping a basketball that bounces and then goes back up to its apex, it should be decelerating. That's what physics tells us to believe, but that's not what the universe is doing.
That's right. So imagine if you threw that basketball up, instead of it falling back to Earth, it started going faster and faster upwards and then just skyrocket out of the atmosphere. That's what the universe itself is doing. And that's a real puzzle because, you know, we know that gravity is the dominant force on large scales in the universe. It should be making the universe slow down. And so we invent this new stuff that we call dark energy. It would make up about 3/4 of all the energy in the universe. And it has to have this very strange property that it makes things repel each other rather than attract. We don't really understand what dark energy is. And the purpose of this new survey is to really try to hone in on the nature of dark energy and really try to get a physical understanding of what it is.
It seems, Joshua Freeman, you all in the astronomy world, to put it bluntly, have done a lot better with dark matter than you've done with dark energy. And I want to understand a little bit more about how this movie, this super powerful digital camera with all the snapshots you're going to take, is going to let you understand something that fundamentally we can't see and can't directly measure. How does such great pictures help you do that?
Right. So there's two things we're really trying to get at here. One is trying to make a better measurement of the history of the expansion of the universe, how fast it's expanding today, 1 billion years ago, 3 billion years ago, 5 billion years ago. And the other thing we're trying to get at is look at this kind of cosmic movie of how structure in the universe is formed. we see these 300 million galaxies, they're all not just uniformly spread around the sky. They're actually clumped together. And that clumping changes over time due to gravity. And so we want to measure that change in the clumping. And those two things will tell us about the nature of dark energy.
But the great thing about this also, Joshua Freeman, is that you're not just looking over great distance. You are looking back in time, right? Because light travels at the speed of light. So, you know, something that's 8 billion miles away is actually 8 billion years into the past. It's amazing.
That's right. And so that's the great thing about looking out in the universe. We're also looking back in time. So the more distant galaxies we see, we're seeing them as they were billions of years ago, and we're seeing them as they were clustered together billions of years ago. And so when we look out at more and more distant galaxies, we actually see that they're less clumped together than they are today. And that's because gravity has increased the clumping over time.
Now, this is dangerous stuff. You know, you could end up upending part of the theory of relativity. You could kind of turn it on its head here.
That's right. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, is we know the universe is speeding up. We invent this stuff called dark energy, which, if it's out there, would be causing it to speed up. But there's another possibility, which is that there's no dark energy at all, and that what's really going on is that our understanding of gravity, Einstein's theory of gravity called general relativity, that might need to be replaced when we get to really, really big scales in the universe.
Joshua Freeman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joshua Freeman is the director of the Dark Energy Survey, scientist at Fermilab, and professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago. Back now to our main story of the day. A few thoughts from you about our interview with NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen. We heard from him yesterday making the case that the world cannot stand aside and allow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to use chemical weapons against his own people. Listen.
It's my firm belief that as regards the chemical weapons attack, we need a firm international response. And in my opinion, it should be tailored, targeted, short, military response. And not to act would also be to act. Not to act would send a dangerous signal to dictators all over the world that they can use weapons of mass destruction.
Sean from New York was none too impressed. He said, I'm flabbergasted that at a moment when the world stands on the edge of the precipice of a huge regional and possibly even broader war, you're busy providing a platform for establishment voices pushing wars, like NATO's Secretary General Rasmussen. Sean adds, enough of providing space to pro-war dishonest figures with a well-documented record of warmongering. What about interviewing the many highly cogent anti-war voices? They exist, you know. Well, Sean, we want to thank you for your comments, and we want to let you know we have heard and will continue to hear from all sides of the story. That includes Tanya Smart from Fort Bragg, California. Tanya says, I've been to Rwanda seeing the skulls, the bullet-riddled church, and the room where infants died. That genocide could have been stopped, but it wasn't. We were afraid to get involved in the civil war we didn't understand, so we did nothing. She concludes, I realize this is a different situation, but the potential outcome seems frighteningly familiar. I enjoy tremendous privilege as the citizen of the United States. When it comes with tremendous responsibility, I don't honestly know what the right action is, but I know doing nothing is unacceptable. Add your voice to this changing debate. Leave a comment on our Facebook page and check us out at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, finally in the show today, we return to a subject that's been talked about all week, the state of the financial world 5 years after this.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street? Let's talk about the speed with which we are watching this market deteriorate.
We're red everywhere, essentially.
We're down over 16%. The stock market is now down 21%.
Because we're now down 43%.
The Dow traders are standing there watching in amazement, and I don't blame them.
A lot of their customers are freaked out, waiting to see how low the Dow will go.
Cicero was right. We're in the last days of this country surviving.
5 years after the global financial meltdown, you've been discussing problems that are seemingly endemic to the world of high finance. It also led us to Jenny Clark, Wall Street's first female trader. But as you might have heard on the program yesterday, she wasn't initially treated like a trailblazer. She was treated like the butt of a joke.
When I graduated from my training class, they got a gold watch. I got a rabbit to go get pregnant. So it was a culture that they thought, okay, I'm a token, but just stand there, look nice, and then leave. Well, my rabbit didn't die.
That's Jenny Clark reflecting on her Wall Street experience in the 70s on this program yesterday. Today, the picture is different, but the industry still struggles to promote women to the boardroom and continues to have a problem holding on to some of its most talented female directors. So what's being done to address that? And is there any reason to suggest that things are, in fact, changing for the better? Rachel Sklar is co-founder of Change the Ratio and The List. These are two organizations which seek to increase the visibility and opportunity for women in the fields that need them. Male Jaro is co-founder and executive director of 2020 Women on Boards, which seeks to change the makeup of Fortune 1000 boards from few or no women to 20% by the year 2020. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Todd. Hi.
Hi. Rachel, let me start with you. We had Jenny Clark on yesterday, an article in The Atlantic basically saying that Wall Street recruits lots and lots of women. Overall, the industry is more than half women, of course. But you go up this pyramid to managers, to executives, to board members, and to CEOs. And by the time you reach the CEO level on Wall Street, the number of women is exactly zero. This is the state of affairs. What's your first step to change this?
I mean, it's a big job, right? Change Ratio started based on the principles of visibility, begetting access, begetting opportunity, being that the very first thing that you can change is highlighting women who are doing amazing things and who are succeeding. And a lot of times in these industries, men get the focus and men refer other men and men step up. And Andrew Ross Sorkin had an article in the New York Times a few weeks ago that lauded the virtues of nepotism and hiring people who are well-connected. It was basically a proponent of the old boys club. And that is what still rules. And Muriel Siebert, who was the first woman to have a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, had said that and fought for that, against that rather, in her whole career. And so what I seek to do is to essentially to bring women together to replicate the old boys club for women so that women refer each other and promote each other. But it's not going to happen alone.
So you say the issue really is networking. And Margot Eprecht wrote an article in The Atlantic, and we had her on the show yesterday. She basically said part of the problem is that women do great on Wall Street when the meritocracy rules. They make money like everybody else. Managers love it. In downturns, when times are bad, like the last 5 years, it becomes about networking. It becomes about politicking. And that's where women lose out.
I think that meritocracy is a word that people like to throw around basically to shore up the decisions that they've already made, because it then puts the onus on people who are quote unquote complaining to say, well, that person didn't deserve to get their position or didn't deserve to rise. But the fact remains that something has to explain the abhorrent ratios in these industries. And it's not just that based on meritocracy. And I think that the ability to make these huge returns also has to do with who you have access to in terms of your clients and who you have access to in terms of your mentors.
All right, let me turn to Male Jaro, if I can, at this point. Male, your organization is 2020 Women on Boards, 20% by the year 2020. Why are the boards the most important part of this to you? Why is it more important to have more females sitting on these boards?
Well, for one thing, one of the points that was made in your show yesterday was the one thing that matters to Wall Street is making money.
Right.
And one of the things that we've seen in a growing body of research is that the boards that have women on them are more profitable. Catalyst showed this in 2011. And last year in 2012, Credit Suisse did a huge study of over 2,000 companies that showed that the companies that had women on their boards, even one woman, those companies had better performance. So we think that these boards that would have women lead by example, we think that boards that have women speak to a changing corporate culture where women in the lower echelons of management feel a little bit more comfortable. So we think it's really important to see women on these boards.
You know, you have data, Male Jaro, and I don't work in Wall Street, but it seems to me, and we talked about this dynamic yesterday on the show, nothing succeeds like success on Wall Street. And if boards and CEOs knew that exact stat, more women, you make more money, the data show it. It seems like argument finished to me. Case closed.
Well, you would think so. It's a very slow process. We think what boards struggle with and what CEOs struggle with is, frankly, a little bit of apathy and a little bit of, well, it's what we do and I'm comfortable doing it. We hear all the time, gee, we'd really like to add women. We really want to do it. We don't know any. And, you know, if they don't know them, they can call us because we can help introduce them.
Molly Jarrow, before we let you go, how about a little naming and shaming for 2020? Name some companies, you know, that have ratios, as Rachel Sklar would say, that are too low?
Well, we do a monthly challenge to our thousands of supporters, and we identify a company with women, 20% or more, and one with and a company that doesn't have it, and we try to stick to the same sector. And last month, we identified Cracker Barrel with a W company and the Cheesecake Factory with the Z. This is all public information. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we're calling out that people don't know. It's accessible. It's just hard to find.
Cracker Barrel along the side of the road, Cheesecake Factory in your mall. Molly Jarrow and 2020 Women is on top of the mall. 2020 Women on boards. Molly, thank you. Also, Rachel Sklar, co-founder of Change the Ratio and The List. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, all this hour, we've been talking about your fondest memories of AM radio. Steve called to talk about his memories of AM radio as a hockey-crazed kid.
At 10 years old, growing up in Queens, New York, I was able to tune in very carefully late at night on my old Emerson wooden AM radio. I was able to get hockey games from Detroit, Chicago, and Toronto, but it had to be a really clear night.
That's right. Marty can tell you how on a lot of those nights you can hear radio from miles and miles away.
When I was a teenager in New York, I discovered quite by accident long-distance radio stations from other places. My favorite, Wayne Rainey's WCKY Jamboree out of Cincinnati. Where I fell in love with bluegrass and old country music and took up the guitar, and I've been playing for 50 years.
Amanda writes on our Facebook page, I remember riding in my dad's orange Vega listening to AM radio. The car always smelled like oil, but Dad loved his car.
Hi, this is Barbara from Riverside, Connecticut. We take an AM radio up to Nantucket every year from Connecticut so we can hear the New York Yankees on the beach.
And for some of you, AM radio still lives on today.
Hi, it's Joan from Palisades, New York. Listening to your show on AM right now in my studio, I can't imagine that we would do away with AM.
Well, thanks for that, Joan. Wherever you are and however you listen, give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can send us your tweets at The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything you hear on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is back tomorrow in FM and sometimes in AM. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.